Chema. Chema, this is a last summary session of, as always, of the chapters we have covered. So, it won't be in all the details of the chapter, but the essence that it conveys. And what we have covered is actually very important. Book 2, Part 1, Chapter 6, 7, 8, 9. So here in these four chapters, we see that Sri Aurobindo tackles two of the most prominent thoughts or philosophies based on whatever experience which have had a great hold on the Indian mind, and to an extent it continues to influence. And if I may add, this influence has been not necessarily to the good of India as far as the nation itself is concerned. So whom does he tackle? But before that, the beauty is Sri Aurobindo makes a clear difference between the person and the philosophy. This is something to be learned. So he takes up Shankara's Mayavad and he completely ends up demolishing the entire architecture on which the whole thing is based. But to Shankaracharya, he pays a high tribute in terms of both his intellect, his rigor, and the way he has gone ahead. And then the third thing which he does, which is very fascinating, he doesn't deny, he puts it in its right place. So every experience has its own utility, its own place in the total truth of things. So what he gives us is the total truth. But there are two ways of looking at total truth. One is, this is also right, this is also right. Another way, this is also right, this also right, but each in its own place. That's what was meant by the rit chit of the Vedic Rishis. So while they were also living in that vastness, Vrhatam, they had discovered the truth, Satyam, but also Ritam, rit chit. Everything should be in its right place. In its right place, things are fine. So what does he do when it comes to Mayavad? He says it has its rightful place. But what is the rightful place? There is a truth of experience. Sri Aurobindo himself had. We all know that, you know. And he has written a letter to that effect. One of his first experiences was where he saw the whole world as if it is just a silhouette taking place against a neutral background. He has spoken of it in poetry. And the problem is, it's one experience which, if we take to the extreme, cancelling all others, then it gives the impression that this is ultimate. And we know that in real life also this doesn't hold true. If you pick up any human being, anything in this world, if you stretch it to its ultimate truth, but disconnect it with all the rest, then you get a truth, but a half-truth. But it's a paradox. So the Isha Upanishad speaks about it, that they who live in the multiplicity alone, and Sri Aurobindo greatly relies in the sense, uses the Isha Upanishad to confirm his own experience with regard to the scriptures. So it very beautifully says that those who live in multiplicity live in ignorance, darkness. It's like you are separate, I am separate, this is separate, everything is separate. But they who enter into a oneness, ignoring completely the multiplicity, they live as if in a greater darkness. So the other is, I am same, you are same, everything is same. And we know the story of the Mahavat Brahman, where the elephant is coming. He says, you are same, I am same, what difference does it make? So the new disciple who has just learnt, and well, the elephant comes near and throws the disciple away, and he comes back to the master and says, well, Guruji, you gave me a wrong teaching. You said all is same. He said, yes, in that case, you should have listened even to the Mahavat. So, the complexity of creation and the ways of the world. So, that's where, when we put things in the right place, we don't need to cut. And that's where he brings in the whole truth of the Mandukya Upanishad, where the Brahman is described as a Chatushpad. It's one reality expressing itself on all the four planes in four different ways. One is its origin, then as it begins to enter a state where it's ready to create or throw cast seeds into creation, then it enters into a dream state and then the Jagrat state. And this is not just, many people say, what is the use of discussing all this? This is true in everything, even in the most practical things. When we deal with each other, we can condemn people by saying, you know, by observing one part, or we can eulogize them, all is Brahman. But there is a totality of things. And when we understand things, place everything in the correct perspective, then life becomes beautiful. I mean, it has many practical things. So first he takes up Shankaracharya's Mayavad, which of course we all know. There are two ways of looking at it. One is an extreme experience where all the world is an illusion and Brahman alone is real. So it raises three questions, or rather, who is the one who experiences that the world is an illusion? Is it an individual? And if there is an individual, is the individual himself a creation of the illusion? If he is a creation of the illusion, then what is the validity of his experience and logic? So this is a big point. Second is, what is the percipient which he is regarding as illusion? Is it the world? And that is one way. And if there is the world, what is it that is perceiving? One is the individual, the percipient. So all these things he raises very beautifully. We'll not go into details because, you know, it's a wonderful, vast subject. But one by one, he says, a typical materialist says that, well, what is illusion? The divine, Brahman, all this is illusion. What is real is the sensory apparatus, and whatever we are perceiving in the world is real. Its other extreme is Brahman alone is real and all this is illusion. And it's difficult to say which one is a better option. Human life swings between these two till it is encountered by the real life. We know the real life. There's a story given by Khalil Gibran that when a person's loved one died, he goes to the doctor and says, what happened? He says, you know, there are some microorganisms, very, very infinitesimally small. You can't see them. But because of that, your loved one died. He says, strange. Microorganisms, I can't see, but they have felt. Then he goes to another, a priest. He says, no, it is the will of the infinite. So he remarks, between the infinite and the infinitesimal, someone has taken away my loved one. You take one extreme or you take the other extreme. Something is missing. So therein he comes into the next chapter. One is reality and the cosmic illusion. Comes to the other aspect of knowledge and ignorance. And here he very beautifully explains in the Vedas. We don't use the word, vidya or an illusion, mithya. That's not how it is used. In the Vedas it is vidya. Or rather, vidya and divya and adivya. So that's how it starts. Divya, there is a divine truth. And there is adivya. So the Vedas understood that life is a struggle between divya and adivya. And there are a number of stories. One of the stories which is very fascinating is the eighth son of Aditi, who is cast into the darkness by the mother, Aditi, as the mother of the gods. And this eighth son is cast into the darkness and he grows up struggling against the light, against the darkness, like in the womb. And this is very interestingly, this eighth son is known as Marthand. And I often wonder, because I have seen the original Marthand temple where it's all destroyed now. And even now there are people who hang out and they are waiting for. But it is very interesting that the whole invasion story, if you start seeing, where was it located? In Kashmir. And it is that sun temple which was destroyed. Before that, there is a very mighty king, Lalitaditya. Very few speak about him. His reign had extended till Afghanistan and all. When that temple is destroyed, slowly we see the entry, the ingress, and finally, as if the Marthand had temporarily conceded to these forces. But cycle of time changed, turned. Now, of course, they have a new Marthand temple, which is different from the original, which is in ruins. You can't, it's very difficult to reconstruct it, but I hope, because Yajna was conducted there, it's very interesting. So the Vedic rishis saw this life as a struggle between the forces of light and darkness, which was very beautiful. At least it gave sense that there are forces of light and their nature is to lead us towards unity, towards harmony, towards beauty, towards truth, truth of things. And there were forces which were opposed to it, and they gave names. There are Vedic names. Mother has used those four names of the four asuras, and the Vedas also speak of the four asuras. Mother gives a story how the one turned into this opposite. So there are forces which are denying it, opposing it. Okay, so that's fine, but what is our state? Very difficult to say whether we are this side or that side of the fence, a little bit of both. So that state where there is a little bit of both is ignorance. Ignorance is not absence of knowledge. That's why the word uses adivya. It is simply that you have not yet recovered the fullness of the divine. It is simply stressing towards knowledge, straining towards knowledge, slipping back, straining again. So this brought in something very beautiful. Shivindu brings in something very beautiful. Ignorance is not like a fixed end. And here ignorance stops, there knowledge begins. And that's what he remarks about the verse of the Isha Upanishad, that very beautifully, that those who live in avidya, ignorance, they live in a darkness. Those who live in vidya alone, they live as if in a greater darkness. And that's why in one of his commentaries on the Isha Vasya Upanishad, he gives the analogy of the author and the book. We can also take the analogy of the classroom. So in classroom, you start from avidya. And extreme of that avidya is a child in the womb who knows nothing. But is that the end of the child or the destiny? No. The child will go on and ultimately express what is there in his, whatever we call it, genes or greater than genes, the super genes, the swabhava, sudharma, he will express. And in that process, there will be a struggle. So there is the divine truth within everything and everywhere, but it is struggling to come out and express itself, and that's what gives to the world the scenario of a fight, quarrel, because this is struggle. Now, we'll not go into why this struggle is there, all that will come later on, and even that serves a purpose in the total scheme of things. But basically, there is ignorance. So now there are three terms. One is the state of knowledge. This is what in the next chapter he described. Knowledge is oneness. Knowledge is not a degree. Knowledge is, you can't say, okay, now I have qualified in knowledge. I have studied all the Vedas. So always we knew the distinction between panditya. One may take a degree in Veda, Vedas, Upanishads, but yet one may not know the one. And we have so many beautiful stories like that, and we have been sharing those stories. To know the one is knowledge. And know not just intellectually, because intellectually we may conceive, but this conception is helpful at a stage. You know, it's one of the most powerful meditations. Often people ask, what is the first thing that Sri Aurobindo gave before the mother's coming? He would say in 1916, there is in the Arya, the letter of the month, what is the idea on which one should meditate? And he gives the idea that the best idea is the one given in the Upanishads. Sorry. All is in the divine. The divine is in all. All is the divine. And this is the verse 7 and 8 of the Isha Upanishad. Yasmin Sarvani Bhutani. So basically it is about that oneness. Oneness here implies that there is the divine in everything, and everything has come from the divine, and it's very logical because there has to be a source. There cannot be multiple sources, that I am from this source, somebody else, everything. And if you reduce matter, living things, mental beings, we'll come back to one source. Even modern science speaks of it, but it closes with energy, that everything has emerged from one energy. And now they are straining to the next level, that where has energy come from? There is a little bit rumor and rumbling that from consciousness. So pretty well science is moving toward that. But we get stuck into this origin, that origin, so many fights. When mother was asked what is the solution for all the quarrels that human beings do, and all the quarrels starting from the quarrel in the home, which is the more difficult quarrel. No, because there is actually a story that, you know, once somebody prayed and prayed and God appeared. So this person who was praying, he said, I am very much moved with the Arab-Israel war going on for so many years. From the beginning, they are fighting. So the boon I ask is, please do some settlement for them. So God said, see, that's a very difficult proposition. You ask something simpler. He said, okay, me and my wife have been fighting. Can you settle that matter? God is quiet for some time. Then he asks his angels, show me that map of Arab Israel. Maybe I can try something on that. So if we know, Mother gave this solution, that what is the solution for all these fights? She said that humanity is from a single source. The humanity is one. If we discover that, religions, everything comes later. But humanity is one. We have a common striving, everything. So it's very practical. This is not just theory and philosophy. People speak about it. If we really start living it, one single experience of it is enough to undo many, many kinds of hypotheses. This is what Sri Aurobindo says, that if we have one experience, all the rational edifices will crumble. So knowledge is the knowledge of the one, and from there oneness. So one and oneness is one, the one reality, oneness in everything. You discover that one in its own way expressing itself. So one and oneness. So what is ignorance? Ignorance is multiplicity. Ignorance, this is my body, this is this, this is a glass of water. Does it have no meaning? Ordinarily, if we take illusionism to the extreme, then this has no meaning. So it's very problematic. So even Shankaracharya brought in something called as a qualified illusionism. You know, use the word vyavarik. Otherwise you can't, when you are living in the world, you can't say this is all illusion. You know, some people go to that extreme. Once one of my MBBS friends, junior, he got married. So he was a lot into all these things. So one day he sends me, I received his marriage card. He says, Priya Atman, Chir Atman. Then he also describes himself as Atman, marrying an Atman. And then he asked for my presence. I said, as an Atman, I will be present. And it will save me the cost of a gift, wedding gift, which I would otherwise had to give. Now I am present as an Atman. You take it that. So you see, it can lead to extreme foolishnesses. So this Shankaracharya is a mighty intellect. He understood this. He said, when you are living within this, this is a practical utility. Neat. Sounds very neat. It's only when you come out. But it leaves a big question and many questions that, well, after all, we don't know if there is any meaning, purpose in all this. Because I am living here, I have to compromise with it. But is there a meaning, purpose? So the meaning and purpose could not be found because there was a separation between Brahman, the eternal reality, and Maya. So Maya was on its way. When you are trapped in Maya, treat it as. And then great saints came in to fill the gap because they have to explain God. So how to explain? They said, it's why this is happening the way it is happening. It's karma. Complete picture perfect. Not really. Because Sri Aurobindo asked this, before man, where was the karma? So if you really look at, and Sri Krishna is much better, he right from the beginning, he puts the entire karma in that cryptic verse in chapter 4 where he says, Arjun, you have forgotten this knowledge, but I have given this to you earlier. But you know, whom did I first give this knowledge? He says, Vivaswan. Now Vivaswan is one of the names of the sun for this Chaturyog. There are other names also. He says, Vivaswan. So I gave it to Vivaswan. Vivaswan gave it to the Ikshvaku kings. And then it came down the generation through the Suryavanshis. And today I am giving it to you. So sun is not just the physical sun, but this entire knowledge, the divine knowledge is with the sun, which is conducting the entire creation. We cannot imagine. There was the sixth ice age was only because 6 days there was no sunlight, blocked purely by the volcanic ash. That time we didn't have atom bombs and no sunlight. 6 days, only 1,000 people survived, and probably they went on to the Himalayas and whatever. I don't know. I mean, nobody knows. And then slowly, but this is science. The Pralaya, because of this. So this has to be, we have to find the link between the two. What is ignorance and what is knowledge is fine, but what is the connecting link? So here Sri Aurobindo gives that link, which again is there in the Isha Upanishad. Isha Upanishad simply says, Vidyancha vidyancha yast dvedo bhayam saha avidyancha mrityum tirtva vidyancha amritam ashnute. The two, vidya and avidya, you have to see them together. With, through avidya, they cross death. Through vidya, they arrive at immortality. So how do they cross death? Very interesting, cryptic verse. So avidya is about multiplicity. How do you cross death? You have to keep pushing the frontiers, the sima, the boundaries of ignorance. Because ignorance is moving towards knowledge, therefore you push the boundaries of ignorance. When you push the boundaries of ignorance beyond a limit, then you cross the borders of death. That's what is happening when people say there is rebirth. There are a lot of studies that, well, with the destruction of the body, something survives. So you push the boundaries, you go beyond death. But you don't discover immortality. That also is there. All this is there in these chapters. He says, even if you prove there is rebirth, which will be proved, that time he says it will be proved one day, soon. That time it was not proved. Now it is proved. Hardcore dogmatic scientists are everywhere. So just like in spirituality or religion, you have dogmatic people, you have dogmatic scientists. Also say, no, nothing is proved. But there are enough studies that there is something which survives death. That's what Buddhism also agrees. But this something that survives death does not automatically prove there is an immortal self. It does not prove that there is a self. So here comes Buddha who says it's all an energy in motion. So there is karma, there is feeling, there are thoughts, they are like energies in motion. They are going from one to another. But very strange theory of transmigration, because they are in Buddhism. But if you really read it, you also wonder. And I was reminded only of one incident in my life when somebody threw a stone to pluck a mango and I thought the stone is going to fall on my head. So I started looking at the stone and moving away from the stone, and I actually came to a point where the stone hit my head. Because my consciousness was on the stone. It gave me a lesson. Don't concentrate on difficulties. They will increase. It's a real life experience. I'm not actually on the center of the head. Even now there would be some scar. Because I was moving away. Then I realized, even now when I drive, if I see there is a pot which I have to avoid, somehow I land up through it. Because I used to wonder why I'm doing it. And then I realized, because my concentration goes so much on the pothole, not the pot, and I feel identified with it, that whatever my thought may be, I end up going through it. So basically, vidyancha vidyancha. So as we increase the boundaries of ignorance, we end up at knowledge. So that's where we must always work towards that. It's not like from here to there. And then the mother gives a very beautiful image of that. What it means is, there is a whole ladder of consciousness. It's there in volume 3. All around is Sachidananda, because ladder is like that, no? Ladder, there are rungs and in between. So if from the physical or vital or mental level, or even higher mental level, we leap. If we leap, we'll experience Sachidananda. But what does it mean? It is what is called in Savitri as a glad divine abyss. That's exactly the problem is. What have you done for the mission? You have leaped into a glad divine abyss. But what is the link? Now for the link, one has to climb up the ladder. This is exactly what Sri Aurobindo does. He says, this secret you cannot discover until you climb the whole ladder and reach the overmind and the supermind where they meet. Then the problem is solved, because that is the place where the vidya and avidya meet together. And that explains why so much sadhana, tapasya, after realizing nirvana, after realizing vasudevam sarvamiti, after realizing parabrahman, because you cannot get the secret of the world till you reach that point where, to use the mystic sense, where the Hiranyagarbha and the Purna Pragya are meeting together. What dreams of eternal are coming into creation, where the transcendent and the cosmic meet. So Buddha did again the same problem, that Buddha also leaped, but he declared before touching that point, and therefore he declared that, well, there is a state of nihil. He basically refused to give names to it, and it is very beautiful that why he didn't give name, because you cannot give name. The moment you give a name, you have defined. So if you define, then it's no more that. Basically, he said, and he didn't want people to get into metaphysical speculation, especially in India. We have a lot of metaphysical, without connecting it to everyday life. So he simply said, spoke of that great nihil. But basically, he's saying the same thing which Shankaracharya is saying. Though apparently, Shankaracharya, who comes a millennium afterwards, he was not happy that Buddha has spoken about the nihil. He has to prove that there is that one. So he proved the one. But regarding world, though no doubt he tried to explain more in terms, very difficult to say who is mightier in intellect. I mean, if I have to give my vote, having read both of them, I would still say in terms of intellect, Shankaracharya is definitely. But Buddha, tremendous vital along with the intellect. Buddha was more about that problem. He didn't create metaphysical system structure. He simply said, all this is suffering. He was out to find a practical solution. So this is what we read. And then, of course, Sri Aurobindo brings in his own, that, well, ignorance is moving towards knowledge. What is behind ignorance, from where creation starts, is inconscient. So inconscient, out of that ignorance emerges. Ignorance is where we all are. But ignorance can collapse into the inconscient, or it can climb toward the knowledge. So when it climbs, does this lose its meaning? No. So that he will come up in other chapters, that what is the meaning of these terms? But since we are, though we have not covered it, we can cover it. And we have covered it in Essays on the Gita, basically, that Vedanta would say that, yes, this is real in a sense that, well, there is an ignorance. You have to realize knowledge. That's the end of the story. But in ignorance, all the structures of the ignorance, our thought, feeling, will, where have they come from? From Brahman? Strange. From an impersonal universality of which nothing can be said? Strange. So the Gita answers it, which is not there in the traditional Vedanta. We must understand that Gita brings in something new. Is the third Purusha. Purushottama, Uttama Purusha. He is Satchidanand Paramatma, the He is has a divine personality of his own. So then this makes sense that, well, my little mind is the mind of mind. This secret one finds in the supermind. And the Gita from that overmind plane tells us. Life, my life, there is life of my life. We see a prayer, no? In prayers and meditation. My little heart, which is beating with love, love, the origin and little loves. Now, if this is so, as the Gita says and Sri Aurobindo confirmed, then there is a possibility that this little love can change into divine love. Because that is the origin. If this is so, then the human mind can change into a divine mind. If this is so, as the Gita hints and Sri Aurobindo's own experience confirms, our little life can change into that super life. And if this is so, our little existence, the physical existence, can change into one with the divine existence. This is the whole logic. But this we have not yet covered. So we'll just first something from, because this we have already read. I'll just read something which Mother speaks of. Very beautifully she summarizes. She has a most uncanny knack, I would say. Of course, we are all partial towards our mother, naturally, no? We should. But see, this is the best way, nowhere else, and I am saying this with all responsibility, having read all these scriptures before turning to Sri Aurobindo, becoming an agnostic after the Vedas, Upanishads, all that. Even the Gita, I said, this world doesn't make sense after all this, but my problem is world. That was my problem, self-created problem. Nobody told me this is your problem. I said, this is not acceptable. This is Maya and take a Nirvana. I said, this is not, this is too selfish. So if I have to be selfish, I might as well be a good doctor. So the mother speaks of the three conceptions. It summarizes most beautifully. She doesn't go into elaborate philosophical musings, but she hits the nail exactly on the head. Three conceptions of the world. Buddhist and Shankarite. Again, she is not speaking Buddha and Shankara. Buddhist, the way it is understood today. Because she had so many experiences with Buddha, especially with Alexandra David Neil, she says, when I told her Buddha is all love, she would say, no, 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 she is in Nirvana. And she saw Buddha standing there and smiling. Because he is love, because he had her own experience documented with in prayers and meditation under the title of Shakyamuni. So she uses the word Buddhist and Shankarite, the way it is understood. What they meant originally is a different story, but from their writing, who they were, that's also not important. When we discuss, it's really something which we have to learn. We straight away go to the person. But we should discuss the truth or whatever the person is saying. It will save many problems. But we start, you know. So what is the first conception? Buddhist and the Shankarite. The world is an illusion. A field of ignorance and suffering due to ignorance. The one thing to do, she has clubbed them together. Now, Shankaracharya will not bother about ignorance. Suffering. It's understood. Illusion means your joy and sorrow both are problematic. And she has added the word field of ignorance and suffering due to ignorance is the Buddha's. Buddha was more concerned about the suffering that we experience. The one thing to do, where the common element comes in, is to get out of it as soon as possible and to disappear into the original non-existence or non-manifestation. This is an experience Shubhendra is not denying. You take things to the extreme, you will vanish into that. Because he had all these experiences, which he has described both in poems, my favorite, Savitri, another favorite, but also in his letters. They are all there, these experiences of the non-manifestation, non-existence. In Savitri, he described this in Savitri's Yoga, book 7, canto 7. Oh my God, it's amazing. And she says, she entered there where if you can speak nothing about it. If being and non-being could flung into each other's arm and vanish, then you will have some touch of that. It's amazing, very powerful. So, as per them, the world is an illusion, a field of suffering. Come out of it. Come out of it where? In the manifestation. Why is using the word non-manifestation, non-existence? Because we may come out of it in Vaikuntha. We may come out of it in Swarga. But if you go there, you will have to, because that is also manifestation. That's why in staunch Buddhism, which is Hinayan, all the gods, including Ishvara, are all ultimately denied. But Mahayan, everybody and everything. Because Mahayan is the northern path, no? It goes toward that, so it has to accept. But Hinayan, Sri Lankan Buddhism, you denied everything. Because there is no truth in any of the experiences. Completely you reject it. The problem with that is, Shobindo speaks of in the Life Divine also we have read. I'm not specifically going back to those passages because of time. But in Savitri also he describes that if we regard that all these experiences are illusion, then maybe that our experience of Nirvana itself is an illusion. This question he raises in Savitri very powerfully. When the queen who thinks that all this is an illusion, She says to Narad that you people, because she assumes that everything is an illusion, then who can say that your experience of Vaikuntha and Vishnu Bhagwan, all this is not an illusion? She's angry. But she has a point. Where ends illusions reign? So Buddha, Shankaracharya, both went to that extreme. All this has to be left behind and denied. But you'll see that there are pujas in mathas. Why? As a, again, the vyavaric aspect. You are in the world. Now, worldly reality is there. It's not true, but you are caught in a, let's say, a horror show. What do? You take help and find the exit door. So, the gods will help you. But they are also an illusion. But Hinayana Buddhism goes to the extreme. That go beyond, don't worry. The second, she speaks of the Vedantic as very commonly understood. So Veda and Vedanta, we must know the difference. It's not Veda. She uses the word Vedanta. This is a subtle difference. Vedanta is the extreme. Vedanta, the end of knowledge, generally refers to the Upanishads. And that's why many Vedantic texts like the Mundaka Upanishad finds, even says, people who are turned to the Vedas, they are still caught in the circle. Because Vedas talk everything. This life, other life, marriage, children, all, everything is there in the Vedas. Vedas is very comprehensive. We'll not talk about that. Probably we can take it up later. But Vedanta is, forget about all this, ultimately there is one reality. So, Vedanta as it is commonly understood, the world is essentially divine. This is what we'll see in Swami Vivekananda's speech, Chicago speech. Sri Ramakrishna went very close to this when he gave the analogy of the mud and the vessel, or gold and the gold ornament. He says, yes, there is a reality. But gold ornament is temporary. So here comes the problem of all creation is transient and temporary. Anityam asukham, as the Gita says. So therefore, okay, agree that it is ultimately there is one reality. Maya has built these things for its own play. But why do you want to play? Because these are temporary, transient things. But are they really temporary? In the Life Divine, we read of that also. That is love temporary or love for an object temporary? Does love cease to be? And there is a beautiful poem of Sri Aurobindo, the Triumph Song of Trishanku, where it speaks about it. That when the nightingale is gone, does the song to end with the singer? A very beautiful, but again, you know, I am everywhere resisting the temptation to flow in that direction. So the world is essentially divine, the Vedanta. It's not just an illusion, we can't. For the divine is omnipresent there. So here is the logic. But its exterior expression is distorted, obscure, ignorant, perverted. The one thing to do is to become conscious of the inner divine and remain fixed in that consciousness without troubling about the world. See, it's coming to the same thing. For this external world cannot change and will always be in its natural state of unconsciousness and ignorance. So it concedes that there is a divine presence in the world. But its movements are full of ignorance. Again, why then Maya comes in all this? So what is Sri Aurobindo's view? She puts as number 3. The world as it is not the divine creation it is meant to be, but an obscure and perverted expression of it. It is not the expression of the divine consciousness and will, but this is what it is meant to become. It has been created to develop into a perfect manifestation of the divine under all his forms and aspects, light and knowledge, power, love and beauty. So again, it accepts that, well, world, common take-home point is world is not perfect. So all life is yoga, never meant that whatever I do, whichever way I do is yoga. That will be stupidity, obviously. Then there is no yoga. Anyways, everybody is doing yoga. So all life is yoga. I had a very funny experience about it once. I think Madurai, there was a talk and once Swamiji had come. And people are of all kind. No, they told him, you say something about, I am also there representing Sri Aurobindo, but people have reverence. So they asked him, here it's very easy. You wear a, you know, Girva Vastra and white kapda and you are revered. So somebody asked a question. Sri Aurobindo says, all life is yoga. So what do you mean? Now he had no clue about Sri Aurobindo. So he said, and I couldn't help laughing. Are, it simply means all you do, you eat, drink, everything is yoga only, no. This is wonderful. Even if he said you offer all this, at least you touch something of the Gita. But even that is not all life is yoga. Remembering and offering is to discover the divine behind all this and in all this. All life is yoga in the highest senses. All this that we experience is a distortion of the divine truth. And therefore it can change into its original. Human thought can change into divine thought. And that's where we see in the Vedas the journey from Navagavaha, and Dasagavaha, the ninefold thought, the tenfold thought. Shobindu says, swimming in a sea of thought, they were not afraid of thinking. That's how he puts it. The rishis, swimming in a sea of thought, they traveled upwards to discover that home of the wonderful. So thought itself can be upgraded. We talk about upgrading the systems. Here we can upgrade. Upgrading thought, upgrading emotions. And life gives abundant opportunity of so-called emotional hurts to upgrade your emotions. To upgrade your will. So she says that, well, it is not what it should be, but it can change. So he says, she says, this is our conception of it and the aim we follow. So there is a clear difference. And why Sri Aurobindo says this? Very simply, because Sri Aurobindo didn't stop only with the experience of Vedanta. Very difficult for people to accept that he also speaks of Tantra, the Divine Mother, and in synthesis of yoga, that becomes the basis. He says the aim of the Tantra, but we start with Vedanta and then we transit to Tantra. So what is the difference between traditional Tantra? Traditional Tantra starts with Devi, the Mother Power, but so you enlarge your powers in every level. But in the end, it ends up with the Vedantic truth. But Sri Aurobindo first realized the divine, the Vedantic truth. Then on that basis, you enter into everything. And everything starts getting transformed. And even for this, the Divine Mother can take you there, will take you there. And that's why the Divine Mother is so important. That is missing because Vedanta and the rishis of the Vedas, they speak of the Divine Mother, no doubt. But she doesn't occupy that prominent place. Tantra as a system came later. And in the beginning, it was so much disliked. They were, you know, their whole stories. That, you know, it is not yoga, it is some crazy thing, stuff. And even now, people have turned it into all kinds of crazy stuff. Tantra spa and Tantra God knows what. Aghoris are not people who are living in Shamshan. For God's sake, they are crazy people who live in Shamshan. Who eat meat, human meat. Aghoris are, you see, it comes from there. They are very, very proper, regular people. But they have done this sadhana. I mean, I have met a couple of them. So I know that aghoris have nothing to do with all. Of course, there are all kinds of people and people do all kinds of things. That's a different matter. But that's not aghor sadhana. So aghor, since we mentioned about it, who is aghor? Aghor is somebody who in everything is discovering the divine shakti. It's very powerful. The word itself, one is ghor tapasya mein leen hai, concentrated. Here is a person who in most normal, natural, all kinds of activities, in its original sense, not today, if you, I don't know what will come on Google search, but Google has the last word, and more foolish than Google is we who believe it has the last word. People are doing all this search on Sri Aurobindo, and I keep reminding, see, supermind is so many places, but if you type search supermind, you will not get those places. Because several places he has spoken of supermind, supramental, but without using the word. He's not a people of the book or a slave of the word. He has reveals the truth. So, then another place where Mother describes again, the usual sadhanas have for their aim the union with the Supreme Consciousness, Satchidananda, and those who reach there are satisfied with their own liberation. From the ladder, any rung one can jump. And leave the world to its unhappy plight. On the contrary, Sri Aurobindo's sadhana starts where the others end. Once the union with the Supreme is realized, one must bring down that realization to the exterior world. Everything must change. Breath and life and speech and act and feeling and gestures and posture, everything. And Shobhita says, if the outer man doesn't change, my sadhana is incomplete. Everything must change. Until a total transformation is accomplished, in accordance with the same, the sadhaks of the integral yoga do not retire from the world to lead a life of contemplation and meditation. When people would ask Sri Aurobindo, I want to come to the ashram to get some mantra, he says, I don't give mantra, mother does not give mantra, she gives work. That's a problem, because after retirement we want a mantra and sit quietly. Each one must devote at least one third of his time to a useful work, any work. All activities are represented in the ashram and each one chooses the work most congenial to his nature. So all this she reveals and why. Okay. And finally, what we are doing now is a new thing. It has nothing to do with the past. And now this is something I am going to just share. I don't know whether it's because I have not gone into and once again examined. But someone observed that when you go to Matri Mandir, is the direction of going to Matri Mandir clockwise or anti-clockwise? Noticed it ever? Okay. It's anti-clockwise, correct? Which is not how parikrama is done normally. So this question was asked. Another reason. Because it's none of the things in the past. There is a lot of undoing and a lot of new doing. So it's not just that she wanted to just break a conception. No. There's a reason behind it. Because it's very fascinating, no? Because Matri Mandir and everything is... It's not like it's just her plan, somebody else did some mischief, no. So she says it has not been done in the past. It's something totally new. We want that, talk a lot more about it, but right now we'll just stop with this answer. We want the divine conquest of this world, the conquest of all these movements and the realization of the divine here. It can be called an adventure because it is the first time that a yoga aims at transformation and divinization of physical life instead of escape from it. And this is the basis, as we have said, Sri Aurobindo brought in once again the unity of Ishvara and Shakti. The two who are one are the right and might in things. Not that Maya, ultimately her task is to deliver. And it has great implications. Mother in one of her talks said, people often ask proof of new world. Here is a proof. For a long time, any religion you take, not only in Hinduism, still people have revered her as Devi. But you take anywhere, ultimately the Ishvara is the final. So there is always the Brahman who is, or the Purusha. Prakriti is only to move around him or whatever, you know, she is. So because of this approach, Prakriti, Maya, and unfortunately to regard the feminine as inferior came into existence. And she set the balance right by saying they are one. This has led to the downfall. And that's why when during the march past, we have photograph of Abhay Singh Nahar and Lighty, I think. So both of them marching and people, Independence Day, and people were throwing stones, some of them threw stones. And this was told to the mother. Mother laughed and said, don't worry, be indifferent and continue. Today, people ask concrete example. Today, women are everywhere, from outer space to prime minister to president. And in many of these things, India has taken the lead. Prime minister, president, proudly. Even recently, 26th January parade, there was a whole Shakti, lot of feminine power was displayed. And things have gone to another extreme, of course, where people are saying, next life, please make me a woman, at least I will... I will have the power. As a man, I have no power. But this is inevitable. So this is one of the most concrete signs of the new world. What was not happening for 2000 years has happened within 50 years. Of course, people don't like it. So our idea of new world is, if things happen according to what I like, then it's a new world. So we'll just read one sentence, because now we have come to the completion. And after all this, the take-home point which he gives us, and of course he says, rationally you cannot solve this dilemma, you have to arrive. That's what he meant, ascending the planes of consciousness, not only at reason. Reason divides, or it does a plus, it doesn't, it cannot unite. That's the problem of reason. So we had stopped with this, and we'll stop here on page 542. Our surface existence, 541 and 542. Our surface existence is only a surface. And it is there that there is the full reign of the ignorance. So if we live there, world will be what it is. Like people who see hostile forces everywhere. So sometimes you have to tell them you came to see the divine everywhere. That means you are into the grip of darkness. First is this. Then yes, there is the struggle. Okay. To know, we have to go within ourselves and see with an inner knowledge. All that is formulated on the surface is a small and diminished representation of our secret greater existence. That's why so much confusion. Everything we see, judge on the surface of things. The immobile self in us is found only when the mental and vital activities are quieted. Any amount of discussion cannot. We may read all about Brahman. We may talk about Brahman, and yet we may not find Brahman. And beyond that, the Ishvara. So the next clue is, since it is seated deep within and is represented on the surface only by the intuitive sense of self-existence and misrepresented by the mental, vital, physical ego sense that there is a self, it's a misrepresentation. Its truth has to be experienced in the mind silence. In the mind silence, the transcendent acts, the hushed heart hears the unuttered word. This is the whole secret. But also the dynamic parts of our surface being are similarly diminished figures. Not only the self, but all our activities from thinking, knowing, understanding, living, breathing, speech, act, heartbeat, love, emotions, force of life, everything is a disfigurement. Diminished figures of greater things that are there in the depths of our secret nature. Mother's prayer is there, no? O thou who art the life of our life, the light of our intelligence. The surface memory itself is a fragmentary and ineffective action, pulling out details from an inner subliminal memory which receives and records all our world experience, receives and records even what the mind has not observed, understood or noticed. Very often you'll meet people pointing out, you remember what you did. You don't know what you did because you associated with a different state of consciousness. But that's how things get distorted on the surface. Our surface imagination is a selection from a vaster, more creative and effective subliminal image-building power of consciousness. That is the Hiranyagarbha, and then there is the Virat outside. So we have the dream state and then the outer waking, and beyond the dream state is the inmost Pragya. A mind with immeasurably wider and more subtle perceptions, a life energy with a greater dynamism, a subtle physical substance with a large and finer receptivity are building out of themselves our surface evolution. What is he saying? He's saying there are the gods who are engaged in building our life. It is the Vedic truth. But he's putting it in a language which the moment you say gods, oh no, 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 this is all superstition. There is a greater, more subtler, they are building. So they are conscious forces. And they are powerful. That was the Vedic yoga. Here we do everything to the mother who is the mother of the gods. So they are building. So what is my self? Is it this ego self? A psychic entity is there behind these occult activities, which is the true support of our individualization. So in the traditional theory of illusion, there is nothing like a true individual. It's an illusion because Brahman has entered and somehow gone into that state of Maya, believes itself to be an individual, which is obviously speaks of then two Brahmans. One who is free, one is bound, which is absurdity. So there is the psychic entity which is formed out of the mother, out of the divine mother's energy. And the divine mother and the Ishwara are one. So that way. The ego is only an outward false substitute, for it is the secret soul that supports and holds together our self-experience and world experience. So what is the ego? Ego is like, you know, a baby is born in the house and baby is too small. So the father, maybe the king, in story of Kartikeya it is there. So he puts a surrogate, somebody to take care. Now someone who is taking care of the prince may well believe, I am the fellow. And prince also trusts blindly. So after some time, whatever people have to get done, they ask, oh, you know the prince, king is not approachable. So prince signs. That's what is the first stage of the psychic. That it signs indifferently. All the checks. But when it grows up, it realizes that, well, I am the higher apparent. Who is this Mr. Mind, Mr. Life, Mr. Body getting my signatures? The moment he starts questioning, there is a problem. Then all the, you know, videos will come out. The moment you question people, then videos will come out against. Because you are questioning, it disturbs a whole way of life to which people are used to. So there is this secret psychic entity. So there is a truth of individuality, which neither Mayavad nor Buddhism speaks of. It's an illusion, they say. And world experience, the mental, vital, physical, external ego is a superficial construction of nature. It is only when we have seen both our self and our nature as a whole. In the Gita, there is a word, beautiful word for this. Krishna Krat. You see the totality, not bits and pieces. When we have seen both our self and our nature as a whole, in the depths as on the surface, that we can acquire a true basis of knowledge. So we'll stop here and the Live Divine Camp will continue in February. Chema.